two bullets. After my parents divorced in the summer after my fifth grade year, I started self-medicating with food. I quickly became the fat kid in school, during a time when most students were at their normal weight. This alone made me very unpopular. I was also one of the smartest kids in school and a complete pacifist who would do just about anything to avoid hurting someone else's feelings. The overall combination of body fat, intelligence, sensitivity, and pacifism made me the ideal target for bullying and humiliation. I still have a dent in my forehead from the kid who threw a ball of solid ice into my face from 35 feet away with the speed and accuracy of a baseball pitcher. The pain was incredible, and the kid laughed sardonically as I cried and tried to stand up. I also have a circular scar along the edge of my left ear from a tent pole that sliced right through the cartilage like a cookie cutter. The pole cut a perfect 1 centimeter wide ring after my friend threw it at me as a joke. He laughed at me and had his dog chase me around the yard while I ran, screaming in agony and holding my ear. He didn't realize what had happened until he noticed his dog licking the blood off of my hand after I had collapsed in tears. This accident required emergency plastic surgery, and I had to wear a large white gauze bandage on my ear for months. Several kids in school called me Vinny, referring to how Vincent Van Gogh supposedly cut his own ear off and mailed it to a woman. I quickly grew my hair out to hide the scar. By the year 1989, I was 16 years old, seriously overweight, 225 pounds at 5 feet 9 inches tall, and completely tired of being bullied and teased. I plunged myself into a grindingly strict and very dangerous diet, drinking a can of cold V8 vegetable juice for breakfast and nothing but water between classes. By the end of the year, without really doing any more exercise, I had become 85 pounds lighter, but the psychological scars of the bullying stayed with me. 5 years later, in July 1994, I was a college student and was working on a music album with my best friend Jude in his apartment. I was thin and moderately athletic, and I had a year and a half of clean time, but I'd never had a girlfriend. I still didn't have the courage to ask a girl out on a date after so many years of threats, humiliation, and physical injuries from other kids. I was struggling to fall asleep as I lay there on the floor, on a cold, dirty air mattress, staring at the ceiling. Jude was sleeping off to my right, 2 feet above the ground, in his normal bed. Jude's apartment was far too small for me to have a separate room to sleep in, as his cousin Reuben was crashed out on the couch in the other room. As I lay there, I was having a weird waking dream. This monstrous, exaggerated fat man, an obvious caricature of how I used to look, was chasing me, trying to kill me. I had a gun in my belt as I ran. I knew I could shoot this man and put an end to my misery once and for all. But for some reason, I wouldn't do it. I didn't want to hurt him, even though he was definitely trying to hurt me. This horrible battle raged on, and I ran for all I was worth as I faded in and out of consciousness. Suddenly, Jude's sleeping body turned in the bed next to me, and in an agitated, distant voice, he said,
"Shoot him. Just shoot him. 2 bullets.
I was galvanized. Instantaneously, I was wide awake. I couldn't breathe. I stared at the ceiling. Everything seemed to shimmer with life. I felt like my body was levitating. My mind was crowded with millions of thoughts, and yet I was ecstatic. I seriously wanted to wake Jude up and tell him what had just happened. but I felt like if I did, we would never get back to sleep, and I desperately needed rest. Somehow, I managed to wait until the next morning to tell him, and we were both dazzled by the implications. The dream seemed to be saying that I was still being ruled by my shadow self. Even after losing all that weight and being completely sober for more than a year and a half, I was still too insecure to ask a girl out. I was so afraid of being rejected that it was much easier to avoid the whole problem entirely. At least that way, I would never get my feelings hurt, and I wouldn't have to feel like that bullied kid again. Now, on some level, Jude had been seeing my dream right as it was happening. I was running, this huge man was chasing me, and I was choosing not to shoot him even though I had a gun, and Jude was watching the whole thing. This strongly suggested that these events had not happened in just my own mind. The dream had occurred in a shared space. Later, I would discover that in 1973, Dr. Montague Ullman and Dr. Stanley Krippner published a comprehensive paper revealing that ordinary people could concentrate on specific images while awake and send them to people who were dreaming. The dreamers then experienced symbols and events in their dreams that were directly related to the sender's message. This fascinating effect was repeated with over 100 participants. The dream seemed to be telling me to let go of that pain, hurt, fear, and buried shame, to symbolically kill off that old tortured part of myself once and for all. That would mean choosing to love myself for who I was, just the way I was, regardless of what other people thought about me. 2 months later, I opened my heart to Yumi, a beautiful Japanese girl, in my senior year of college, and we fell in love. She was so fascinated by my blue eyes that I finally let her touch my eyeball one day to confirm it was real. Human nature. Barely a week after the two bullets incident, on July 17, 1994, I was still on the summer break between my junior and senior years of college and 1.5 years sober. My parents had insisted I take a job during every summer break since my second year of high school. The pain of disagreeing with them was worse than riding my bicycle in the rain or taking the public bus to work. I was quite accustomed to the sharp odors and prying looks of homeless people, and to the men in the ties looking right through me as they glided by the bus stop. Now my father had loaned me $2,000 to buy my own car, and here it was. I painstakingly installed a new Radio Shack stereo system in the beat-up old red station wagon, which was big enough to hold all of my and Jude's musical equipment, including my entire drum kit. Fake wood panels lined the sides, and I had already cleaned and detailed the interior of the car so thoroughly that it looked brand new inside. Michael Jackson sang away in my mind as I worked on the stereo system in silence. Why? Tell him that it's human nature. Why? Did she do me that way? Finally, the moment of truth. I connected the last speaker wire to the stereo, sealed it off with a sticky black strip of electrician's tape, shoved it back into the dashboard, and hit the on button. The radio roared to life. Staggeringly, the exact same song I had been hearing came blasting out. Michael's vocals were perfectly synchronized with the very same moment they had reached in my mind. The song wasn't even off by a fraction of a second. I did not have any dental fillings, so I could not have pulled in radio stations through my teeth. nor was anyone else playing music in the area. I had been hearing the song for at least 20 minutes before the radio came on. I spent months trying to figure out how this one event could have happened, particularly in a universe that is supposed to be limited by the constraints of linear time and by minds that are supposed to be separate from the greater environment around them. Synchronicity is fickle. It doesn't always work. It's not there to pleasure your ego on demand. Once you become aware of the possibilities that exist and have had your first taste, you can beg, cry, long for it, and beseech the great forces of the universe to give you another chance. But synchronicity makes its own rules. Time is irrelevant. The next event could be 10 years or 10 minutes away. I had very few experiences of synchronicity until after I completely stopped using any and all mind-altering chemicals, including caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol, and started cleaning up my diet. I also came to learn that the greater meaning of a synchronicity may not always be apparent when it first happens. I drove the car to my new job for the first time, and it was wonderful. A 2-hour trek requiring 3 different buses was now shaved down to a 35-minute drive. However, at the end of the day, an enormous cloud of smoke belched out of the car when I started it, quickly engulfing a family walking behind me, and the smoke just kept on coming. I was devastated. A new friend I met at work came to the rescue, and she gave me a ride home. The car was towed all the way back to a garage in my hometown, which was not cheap, and it was declared dead on arrival. Head gasket. The whole engine block was cracked. No way out. I was terrified that the elderly couple who had sold it to me would keep the money. I felt so lost, so alone, so confused. My father couldn't afford to give me another loan, and it would take me another year, because I was a full-time student, to earn enough money to pay back the original loan and try again. Yet I couldn't deny the miracle that had happened. Were they really going to take the money and run? Was this the human nature Michael Jackson had sung about? Had those lyrics given me a sinister warning about how they were going to do me that way? Or could I trust in the good vibes they'd shared with me when I bought it and get my money back? After 2 days of grinding suspense, I nearly cried with relief when I found out they would take the car back and return the money. They honestly did not know the car was about to die. The synchronicity was a message that all was well before I even knew there was going to be a problem. I was indeed being guided and protected by mysterious unseen forces that could influence human nature and make miracles happen. Linear time did not seem to pose any barrier to whoever or whatever had done this. It is impossible to predict where or when synchronicity will occur. Then one day, it does. And in that brief, tantalizing moment, you have touched infinity. You have tasted that which cannot be tasted. You catch a fleeting glimpse of that which cannot be seen, and yet it is just as real as the eyes that gaze upon it, the ears that hear it, and the mind that revels in it. Now there is no place to hide. That lonely, tortured soul that believes in suffering, pain, and separation is isolated and cornered. It fights valiantly to maintain its rigorous enchantment with despair and misery, and its addiction to drama and victimhood. But after enough synchronicity, it simply cannot dare to claim any further relevance. Now the lies are stripped away. the truth is revealed. The world we've been taught to believe in is a sham. The universe is vastly more mysterious and wonderful than we assume. And we are loved more than we could ever possibly imagine. A little bird told me. Synchronicity often emerges from the depths of despair as a hidden connection between seemingly unrelated events. We all have to go through what people in 12-step support groups would call the bottom at various times. Psychoanalysts who follow the work of Dr. Carl Jung call it the dark night of the soul. When we go through this experience, it seems like it's the end of the world, but we can learn to see it as only one part of a much greater series of events in our own evolution. This experience also happens on a collective, planetary level as we go through the great repeating cycles of wars, disasters, and epic changes. Seemingly random thoughts, decisions, and actions throughout history are actually following a hidden script. Ultimately, we all know the script. And we constantly seek out creative works that keep telling us the same story, as we will see. Dr. Jung found that there were a series of symbols and experiences that we all encounter, often in dreams. These symbols and experiences remain consistent regardless of where we are from, historically and geographically. They are called archetypes, and they range from the most difficult and horrible experiences we will ever endure to the most breathtakingly transcendent moments of clarity and triumph. Together, they create the grand story of enlightenment, which Joseph Campbell called the hero's journey. I have had hundreds, if not thousands, of ego-crushing experiences as I traveled along my own hero's journey to greater wisdom and understanding. I used to be that guy who wanted other people to take care of him and was terrified of adult responsibility. By the time I graduated from college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology, I had experienced many mind-blowing synchronicities. But I had also lived on campus all 4 years, straight out of high school. I had never paid rent or bought my own food from a store on any consistent basis, as I always had a meal plan, and I made sure I never ran over budget on my meal card. I was absolutely terrified of graduation, as I knew it was almost impossible to get a well-paying job in New York State with a bachelor's degree in psychology. There were far too many unknown variables. I knew many students who lived off campus and were buying food and paying rent with very little money. Many of them were living on instant ramen noodles, spaghetti, and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and they lived in a constant state of anxiety. I remember the moment in August 1995, right after graduation, when I absolutely knew, without question, that my mother was indeed kicking me out of the house I'd grown up in all my life. She'd gotten tough. She wouldn't take no for an answer. There was nothing I could do. There was no turning back. Now I had to throw myself to the wolves of the corporate world and try to survive on depression-level wages.